I'd like to call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order at 1:05 p.m. Today is Monday, February 19th, President's Day. And members present today are Representative Birch, Representative Parrish, Representative Tallarico, myself, co-chair, Representative Josephson, Representative Drummond, Representative and Vice Chair John Lincoln was here and will be back momentarily. we actually have a quorum at this time. It's not necessary for the substance of today's hearing, but we have one. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Butch Carber, and our LIO moderator, Doug Bridges. I remind members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. Last Friday, the 16th of February, we heard from the Pebble Partnership. We also heard from several individuals that live in Southwest Alaska on the issue of the Pebble Project. Today, we'll hear from mine opponents. We have seven invited witnesses. Please hold questions until the end of each presentation. We'll begin today's hearing by hearing from Mrs. Lindsay Leyland, who will give, I'm told, just a brief presentation and then to handle any questions, if you'll approach. If you'll just give us your name, Ms. Leyland, and any affiliation.
Yes. For the record, my name is Lindsay Leyland, and I'm the Deputy Director at United Tribes of Bristol Bay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Lindsay, and I'm the Deputy Director at UTBB, which is a Dillingham-based tribal government consortium representing 15 tribes in the Bristol Bay region, and with those tribes, over 80% of the population who live in Bristol Bay year-round. With the short time that I have with you all this afternoon, I'd like to provide committee members with a brief overview of what I believe are critically important pieces of information about our perspective on the Pebble Mine. First, we have the continuing opposition to the Pebble Project by the people of Bristol Bay. Pebble has been an issue long enough that memories start to get hazy as to how all of this got started. But in fact, I was just 10 years old when Northern Dynasty bought into the project, and I've quite literally grown up with the threat of Pebble Mine. To be clear, the people in Bristol Bay have opposed this project from the beginning. This opposition is not rooted in general disagreement with mining or resource extraction or economic development. I want to be really clear on that. Rather, our opposition is rooted in the time-honored saying that everything depends on location, location, location. No matter how the Pebble Partnership wants to spin it, this deposit rests under and in the wetlands, streams, and surface and groundwaters that are responsible for Bristol Bay salmon. Dr. Dan Schindler is behind me. He's going to testify later this afternoon. And he can speak more directly to the importance of these water systems to salmon. But I will say that this was the issue that brought Bristol Bay people to action, and it all started with tribal elders. People like Herman Nelson, Lukey Acklecock, and Bobby Andrew are long-time subsistence users who know that those waterways, like the way many of you know the streets of your hometown, and they knew, and they were the first to tell us that we must protect these waters. Which brings me to my second point of fish. Bumper sticker slogans aside, Bristol Bay is defined by its fish and pristine fish habitat. Norm and Nancy behind me will also testify later, and they will go into the economic opportunities that fish provide to Bristol Bay. But what I'd like to emphasize is the critical role that these fish play in the way of life of Bristol Bay's people. According to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, families in Bristol Bay harvest on average between 150 and 500 pounds of salmon each year for subsistence purposes. With that in mind, I want to take the opportunity to directly address something that you all heard last week from General Hamilton. He provided the committee a slide indicating that the North and South Coquitlam Rivers are responsible for merely half of 1% of Bristol Bay salmon. But if we actually look at his slide's language, that half a percent number is in reference only to sockeye salmon. And as the committee is well aware, we in Bristol Bay are blessed with all five species of salmon. And those rivers described by General Hamilton as unimportant to the overall numbers of Bristol Bay sockeye provide the spawning and rearing habitat for two of the most important subsistence resources in Bristol Bay, which are king and silver salmon. Catching Bristol Bay sockeye may put money in our pockets, but kings and silvers put food on our tables. And I'm not here to argue about hypothetical impacts to those waters or those fish, and that's because it's undeniable that there will be impacts. The construction and operation of the Pebble Mine is going to require dewatering streams. It is going to require filling in wetlands, and it is going to require changing the way water moves throughout the system, both on the surface and through the ground. And those are the impacts that come from just the day-to-day operation of a mine, and that's why the people of Bristol Bay oppose this mine. Finally, on a more personal note, I want to address one last comment made by General Hamilton. In his testimony, he made several references to how the opposition to Pebble is fueled by passions rather than science. In response, I would like to say this, that I'm 27 years old. I'm a small business owner, and I have invested a lot into my commercial fishing business. I grew up in Bristol Bay, and I call it my home to this day. And the science and history surrounding this issue have led me to a resolute opposition in this project. The science has led me to an opposition in this project. I am passionate about protecting my way of life. And with all due respect to the general, I have every right to be passionate about protecting my business, my livelihood, and my home. And no one has the right to tell me otherwise. And so with that, thank you for the opportunity to speak this afternoon, and appreciate you guys taking the time.
Thank you, Ms. Leland. Are there any questions for the testifier? Yes, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, Ms. Leland, thank you for being here. You mentioned that the United Tribes for Bristol Bay represent over 80% of the regional population. What's your sense on the tribal members' support? What's the fidelity of the signal being transmitted through the United Tribes of Bristol Bay in terms of popular feeling?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Parrish, I would say that, I mean, you know, the member tribes of Bristol Bay, who again are 15 member tribes, you know, as far east as Non-Dalton and Pedro Bay on the lake area, and our tribes are committed to, you know, protecting and preserving their way of life, and that sentiment, I think, from the representation of the people who sit on our board and represent their tribal councils and their communities, that it's vast and it's strong, and that support ripples through the communities that make up Bristol Bay.
Follow up?
Yes, follow up.
Has it been your experience that there's much controversy around that general point?
Through the chair, I would say that in any community there are opposing sides, but again, from my personal and professional experience, we have witnessed and really been able to participate in this pretty comprehensive opposition and pretty resolute standing, I would say. And I know that there are tribal members and there are some communities who have a different opinion, but again, speaking just on behalf of UTBB, I would say it's pretty consistent.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not familiar with the distribution of employment in your communities, but do you have constituents or constituencies that are working either in the North Slope or elsewhere? And the reason I bring that up is our resource committee actually toured the Greens Creek mine last year, and there's over 1,000 jobs in Juneau and in the Juneau area that are employed in the mines here. But are you aware of any, or are there people that commute out of your communities to work either in the Slope or elsewhere? I mean, is the access pretty good?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, you know, I truly can't speak to it. I don't know a tremendous amount of people who do. I've known one or two here and there, but I actually can't answer your question. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Ms. Leland. We're going to move on now to Norman Van Vactor. I'm going to be a little bit more careful about the time element. Mr. Van Vactor, if you give us your name, any affiliation, and provide your testimony, you're welcome to do so.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the privilege of being here today. My name is Norman Van Vactor, and I'm the President and CEO of the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, one of the 6 CDQ groups here in Alaska. Our corporation represents 17 coastal communities extending from Port Hyden on the Alaska Peninsula to Togiak out to the west. BBDC's corporate offices are in Dillingham, Alaska, and I'm proud to call Dillingham my home. BBDC's mission is all about supporting, enhancing, and promoting sustainable, renewable economy. Our last 5 years rolling average has had us committing to and spending in excess of $22 million a year of our net income in those 17 communities and in the watershed. Bristol Bay is about salmon and one of the few fisheries of its kind remaining in the world. I am particularly honored to be here today with community and Native community leaders, as well as probably the two most respected scientists representing fisheries and geology, bar none. From them, you're going to hear from them the science based on fact and not the hypothetical. Throughout the years, I've witnessed the immense economic engine generated from the annual salmon run swimming into Bristol Bay. Bristol Bay alone boasts the most valuable and largest salmon fishery remaining in the world, and yes, I said the world, typically supplying almost half, if not a little bit more than half, of the world's wild sockeye. My brief testimony today focuses on the importance of the Bristol Bay economic engine based upon this fishery and the role that government and regulatory agencies need to play and should be playing to assist the people of the state of Alaska and our region to protect our important culture and economic resources. Just a few short years ago, I had the privilege of chairing the governor's fisheries transition team. And the resounding theme that came out of that group and our number one statement was, in any conversation that the state should be entering into, it should start with fish first. Subsequent to this, and just a year ago, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game actually wrote the legislature a letter as well asking for more of the same. Well, here we are. What's happened? Really nothing. Well, with no action, what do we get? A reaction. Efforts like those of the sponsors of HB 199 and the Salmon Initiative are part of that reaction and are helping to move and drive that very conversation. Where is our Bristol Bay management plan? When the Pebble Partnership now talks about a smaller mine footprint, shouldn't that also call into, you know, review their water rights application? Shouldn't that be looked at as well? These are all questions that we think need to be answered and deserve to be answered. The people who call Bristol Bay home have one commonality. Our lives and our economic focus is salmon. The economic importance of the fishery extends well beyond Bristol Bay in Alaska. We touch the Pacific Northwest and, by extension, the entire country and the world. Over 14,000 documented jobs now, in excess of $1.6 billion. Over 2,300 small business owners that we call fishing families. These statistics, quite frankly, are a little dated by 2 or 3 years. But one thing we do know, just last summer alone, over 60 million, or just about 60 million fish showed back up on our beaches and our rivers. To quote others, jobs like ours are part of a long chain of hardworking Americans catching, processing, transporting, and selling salmon and supporting this economic engine. Another significant point that I think needs to be made is that when you look at this gross revenue of over $1.6 billion that the state benefits from, how much does it cost the state to do that? Little over in excess of about $2 million of support for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And quite recently, ourselves and others are actually collaborating to underwrite that. Where else can the state see that type of ROI? Bristol Bay is sustained by salmon. The commercial, sport, and subsistence fisheries all play a key role in keeping the region's economy and cultures alive. While the company claims to have small impact on salmon, the numbers it talk about only refer to sockeye. And I guess I'm going to skip that part because I know Lindsay talked about that. There are just so many untruths that they are telling to advance their project that we, the people of Bristol Bay, implore you to see through these deceptions. Summer after summer, millions of sockeye salmon return home. We could use more jobs, but just not Pebble Mine jobs. We can't afford the risks to build it. The Pebble Partnership promises they can build a mine that will not harm salmon. But to most of us, it seems disingenuous, especially in light of the recent dam tailing failings, such as Mount Polly, by example. Polly, too, is supposed to be a small mine that would cause no harm. How very wrong again. Even given the modified footprint of the Pebble Mine and the type of resource to be mined, copper and gold, it is clear that this mine cannot coexist safely with salmon. Clearly, fish and fishing communities lose when toxic tailings are involved. Such is a picture I don't think any of us would bear to consider, and is the reason we wholeheartedly support the efforts to place protections for salmon without turning away the responsible mining interests that might, in fact, be able to provide protections for our land and guard our water safely. I'd like to just share with you a quote from Ron Thiessen, the CEO of Northern Dynasty. This was in December of 2017. The area looks more like Kansas than it does the rest of Alaska. There are some shrubs in the lichen growth, mainly what we describe as shattered rock. And it's kind of the ideal location for a mineral resource project. It's out there in the middle of, you know, there's really nothing around. Well, quite frankly, for those of us that live and breathe and benefit from the resource out there, there's a hell of a lot around. And we take affront to statements like that. There is a legitimate national interest in protecting clean water that has for centuries supported the people and economy of our region. As recently as last month, even the new administration and EPA acknowledged the extraordinary value of the resources of Bristol Bay. As a businessman, I would welcome a government or regulatory agency telling me up front the core parameters of what's going to be required for my permit. The pure and abundant waters of Bristol Bay support a salmon fishery that is the very foundation of our region, unique in the world, and truly a national treasure. The people of Bristol Bay have our own varied sets of challenges, but at the end of the day, we're like-minded when it comes to protecting a resource and a way of life that has served and sustained our region for hundreds of years. Bristol Bay will continue to sustain our communities if we do our part. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Van Vactor. Any questions for this testifier? Yes, Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You've mentioned the valuation of the fishery. This is the same committee is going through a lot of discussion now about raising the minimum tax on oil, in addition to the royalty share of oils that we derive off the North Slope from 4% up to 7%. What percentage of the $1.6 billion or whatever the valuation is of that fishery is paid out in taxes? Do you have a ballpark on that?
I don't have a ballpark. Probably, well, I do have a ballpark. My ballpark would be right around 2.25%. It does vary a little bit at the end of the day because some of the different boroughs in turn have taxes that are placed river system by river system.
Follow up, Representative Birch.
You think that would more equitably be, you know, bumped up to say 4%? Or I mean, I just haven't studied it that hard. I'm paying very close attention to the the interest in, you know, kind of escalating the taxes on a state asset. And I just would be interested in seeing if there's any room there, if you will.
Well, I think there's always room, but at the end of the day, any taxes that you would get imposed would in all likelihood, quite frankly, unfortunately, get passed along to the lowest common denominator. Mm-hmm. And who's that? Our fisher people. Mm-hmm. And the residents of the region, some of the very same people that could least afford it.
Mm-hmm. And just to recall, in 2016, the governor proposed an increase to the fisheries landing tax. I frankly didn't have it before me in any committee, and so I wasn't studying it as closely, but virtually every revenue known to the state would have paid something more under the governor's plan, and every tax was rejected by the legislature.
And one other thing I might also point out is the tax, in turn, is got two tiers to it. There's a tax based upon shore-based processors and then a tax for floating processors. I think at the end of the day, the idea with shore-based processors is that given that communities have a lot of skin in the game and a lot of potential associated costs in supporting those industries, that some of those general funds flow back to those communities that those plants are based in.
Okay. Follow up. And can you pull the mic closer, Mr. Van Vactor?
Yes, sir.
I'm familiar with the Juneau Economic Development Corporation, the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation, and the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation. From the standpoint of your, are you looking at? Where does mining fit in, or anything besides fishing? In your view, is there any merit to having some diversity of economic development and jobs? And again, I'm familiar with Northwest Alaska, where, you know, Red Dog Mine has provided, you know, six-figure incomes for countless residents over a long period of time. But are you at overall economic development, or you've zeroed in on the fishery side by itself?
A little bit of both, with an emphasis on fisheries. I mean, at the end of the day, we're again one of the six CDQ corporations was created as part of the Magnuson-Stevens Act a little over 20 years ago. We benefit from our revenue streams that are generated principally in the Bering Sea. We're charged with investing in those resources. I mean, we don't go out and invest in Honda or GM or anything like that. Our investments are get rolled back into the fishery. We buy boats, we buy quota, we buy allocations. Our charge is to spend. We're a nonprofit. We spend that money directly back in our communities. So at the end of the day, we are charged, and every CDQ group is a little bit different. They can develop a lot of their own specific charges. And so in our region, you know, my board of directors has basically said we are supportive of sustainable, renewable economy. And, you know, I come from a family of South Dakota gold miners. I'm not anti, again, I'm a businessman. I'm charged with developing jobs. But at the end of the day, it needs to be the right jobs for the right place.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Mr. Van Vector. We will now proceed on with the next testifier, and she is Nancy Morris Lyon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank all of you for being here. I'm Nancy Morris Lyon, and I own and operate Bear Trail Lodge, a recognized five-star lodge located in Bristol Bay. I started as an independent fishing guide in the Bristol Bay area in 1985, when it wasn't common for women to be sports fishermen, much less fishing guides. There are dozens of lodges of various degrees of luxury in the area of Bristol Bay. The bay became a key sport fishing destination before I was born, and it is known as the birthplace of flyout fishing. Movie stars, sports stars, dignitaries, and even presidents come to Bristol Bay to fish. This worldwide recognition has established sport fishing as an incredibly important part of the local and statewide economy. Our lodge operations have become an integral part of Bristol Bay. We depend upon local businesses to provide us with fuel, food, transportation, and many other support services, including individual employment. The recreation fishing, hunting, and tourism industry has been documented as supporting more than 1,000 jobs and contributing more than $60 million a year to Bristol Bay and Alaska's economy. Because of its remote nature and pristine beauty, Bristol Bay has become recognized as a national treasure by Alaskans and visitors alike, a fact that has been solidified by thousands of sportsmen and women who have stepped forward to support efforts to halt Pebble Mine and other mines like it. Tourism is a bright beam of sunlight in the economy. Thousands of visitors from the lower 48 and all over the world bring their money into Alaska year after year because Bristol Bay has something to offer in its vast, untouched beauty that no other place has been able to create or establish, and this needs to be acknowledged and protected. I hear a lot of talk about the salmon and the effects that mining could have upon the runs and returns, but it's also important to recognize that we spend at least 2 months of our season, which is very short, guiding guests who focus on fish other than salmon. Our grayling, Dolly Varden, and Arctic char are some of the largest and most prolific fish in the watershed. These fish pale in comparison, however, to our mighty and incredible rainbow trout. Fishermen don't even care to touch or see a salmon when they are focused on our world-renowned trout. Pebble's current plan is requesting transportation corridors that would cross two of Bristol Bay's most famous fishing rivers, Tulare Creek, whose name is synonymous with giant rainbow trout, and Gibraltar Creek, where visitors covet the days they can spend on its beautiful and peaceful waters. Placing these corridors on or even near these fisheries will eliminate the reason many visitors join us year after year. Without a pristine and relaxing environment to visit, a large percentage of our fishermen will choose not to return. 35 round-trip dump truck loads barreling by each day, blasting taking place over the hill, and an entire infrastructure required for the mine will eliminate what many of our visitors crave. Pebble's current plan, as well as the anticipated expansion, fundamentally changes the landscape. People don't come to Bristol Bay to fish amongst roads and noise. I have family generations of fishermen who come to visit each year, many on the fourth generation. They come to experience what they cannot find anywhere else, and they value it so much that they visit every year, making sure that their family gets to see and experience it as well. The recognition of this value, as I viewed it through the eyes of my guests, was a major factor in my decision to become the lead instructor of the Bristol Bay Guide Academy. I felt that if we could get the residents of the area involved in guiding and sports fishing, they could show my guests a way to experience the area through a whole new set of eyes and values. To me, it was a surefire way to know that visitors received a whole picture of Bristol-based traditions, and it would help them understand why she is so special. I'm incredibly proud to say that the Guide Academy is entering its 10th year, and many of its graduates are and have been employed in the sport fishing industry. There are a number of graduates on sport fishing payrolls every year. One great example is of a young man who was really just a boy, born and raised in Bristol Bay, and he has lived there his entire life. Even though his parents were lifelong set netters and subsistence fishermen, he fell in love with sport fishing. When he first came to the academy, he was 15 years old, and like so many other youth in the area, he was very shy and had a really difficult time speaking to folks. He quickly rose to the top of his class with his fishing ability and passion for the sport. Realizing his potential, we reached out to him and explained he was going to have to be willing to learn to communicate and share with guests if he really wanted to become a guide. To make a long story short, he has now been a guide in my employment for 5 years. I've had the privilege of watching him struggle and grow into an incredible guide and a very confident young man who is aware of who he is and what he stands for. Communication has become second nature to him, and he is very good at it. He has become one of the top guides in the area, and he's someone I count on now to train my new employees. The stories he shares and the history that he brings to life for my guests and other employees cannot be brought to life without his telling it. By the way, his given name is Kwee-Jack. Bristol Bay can and is creating a positive future for itself that does not involve terrifying hazards and risks beyond measure. It does not involve or need a landscape that is so vastly changed that it displaces and collapses an established industry. Let safety be the first priority. The minerals in the ground are not going anywhere. Perhaps there will come a day when it will be safe to remove them from their resting place, when technology allows mining to be done without dangerous chemicals and ravaged landscapes. Not now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Morris-Lyon. Before I take questions, I want the record to reflect that we were joined previously by Representative Lincoln, who's been here virtually the entire meeting, Representative Tarr, who's been here virtually the entire meeting, and somewhat later, but most of the meeting, Representative Rauscher. Representative Parrish, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony, Ms. Morris-Lyon. This might be more properly a question for Mr. Van Vector. I'll let you figure that out between you. What proportion of the jobs in the area are connected to fishing or connected to tourism, and what are the trends? Do you see many more people like Mr. Kwee-Jack who are
Yes, I can answer it probably with not the hard facts that you'd like, although we can probably come up with those for you, but the trend is definitely headed more towards tourism. That's a national fact, and the tourism is headed to areas that are harder to reach because people crave that when they live in concrete villages where they are. It is very, very difficult for them to get that experience anywhere else, and that's what's made Bristol Bay become such a strong place for people to want to go. I mean, they crave the ability to feel like maybe they just put their foot on a piece of tundra that nobody's ever stepped on before.
I follow up, Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Just a quick comment. I once twisted my ankle doing just that with a little piece of ground here in Juneau.
Not
okay. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cool. I got to come out and try some fishing.
Thank you.
One question I had, the fishing industry, as far as the statewide, has got a dismal record as far as the number of Alaskans employed. I mean, there's a lot of, it seems like all the big ships are coming out of Seattle and whatnot. But in your experience, what's an average salary for a guide, an annual salary? I realize it's pretty compressed. And then what would you say is the percentage of guides in the business there that are local or Alaska-based or Alaska residents, if you will?
Yeah, through the chair. Actually, it's hard to come up with a salary because our salaries include room and board, they include transportation, they include clothing, they include your gear. So I don't really know what that honest number is. I would be hard pressed.
20,000, 50,000?
Yeah, I would say between probably 30 and 50,000 a year would be it.
Okay.
I know, speaking for myself, that over 85% of my employees, including guides, are Alaskan residents and residents of the area.
Yeah.
So, but to I also know that that is a fact that hadn't previously, I mean, it's something that is coming about. It's not something 30 years ago when I was first in the business, it's not something that happened. Everything was from out of state, including the guides and the employees. Not so much anymore.
Okay. Representative Tarr.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. You mentioned two creeks at the beginning that were really important for trout fishing, and I didn't get a chance to write those down. I just want to understand the location of those.
Yes, Tulare Creek and Gibraltar. And they're for those invested in the fly fishing world, everybody knows exactly what they are and where they are. That's how well recognized they are.
Thank you.
All right, we're now going to move on to, thank you, Ms. Morse-Line. We're now going to move on to Dr. Chambers, followed by Dr. Schindler, and I've invited them to give somewhat longer presentations. That will be bookended by others who will present for a somewhat shorter period of time. Dr. Chambers joined us last year. He had been working with the United Tribes of Bristol Bay on this issue.
Yep.
Chambers.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Chambers. I'm a geophysicist with the Center for Science and Public Participation, which is a small nonprofit located in Bozeman, Montana, although we do have an employee here in Alaska. Size matters. I've been asked to review some of the figures that you've seen from the Pebble Partnership and the assertions that this is a small mine. So I'd like to start out by showing you some information that was presented by the Pebble Project in September of this year. And they're talking about their total resource, and they're calling 6.44 billion tons of measured and indicated ore and another 4.46 of inferred for a total resource of 10.8 billion tons. Now, the number that they quoted to you for their small project last week was 1.1 billion tons. So that's roughly 10% of what they're telling investors they have. And the Security and Exchange Commission in the United States and its counterpart in Canada are all very careful about what companies are and are not allowed to say, and a company cannot go out and promote something that it doesn't have. To do so is fraud. So the numbers that we're looking at here are the numbers that the company is telling its investors it has to develop.
And Dr. Chambers, is it your understanding that they continue to do this after last fall, indicating that their mine would be a quarter the size or whatever it is they've indicated?
As far as I know, you know, this is the most recent information, and yes, they continue to put this out there, and in fact, they'd be hard-pressed to retract it at this point because
thank you.
They would have to issue a retraction. So I'd like to step back and look at what they were saying in 2012, starting out by looking at what they had identified then as pretty much the same size. They picked up 100 million tons, but that's just sort of change at this point. But at that time, they did what they called a preliminary assessment, which is a pre-feasibility study. And a pre-feasibility study is a study that looks at the economics of a mining operation to an accuracy of 20 to 30%. And during that study, they looked at three cases that they wanted to develop. They have an investment case, which was a 25-year case, what they called a reference case, which was a 45-year case, and then a resource case, which was a 75-year case. Now, in those examples, the 25-year case was 2 billion tons of ore to develop. The reference case was 3.8 billion tons, and the 78-year resource case was 6.5. And then to comment on that, the total resource is roughly 11 billion tons, so even their resource case is roughly only half the size of the actual resource that they have identified. These are just little models of the open pit. The red one would be the 2 billion ton pit, the gold one would be the 3.8, and the gray one would be the 6.5. It's also important to know that there's an underground resource out there. So here we have a schematic, as it were, of the open pits that would be developed, and there you have a simulation of what the underground resource would be. This would be done by block caving, and the way you do block caving is you drill a hole straight down underneath the deposit, and then you go up and fracture it and let gravity let that material fall into your collection points at the bottom. It's a rather rough way to mine, but by allowing gravity to do a lot of the work for you, it's fairly inexpensive. The point here being that even though this is underground, that particular method almost always causes surface subsidence because you're removing a lot of material. You're basically removing the support from underneath the ground at the surface. That particular area, and this particular diagram is located roughly north-south, is to the north and to the east of the open pits, and that's the area in the upper watershed of Upper Telluric Creek. This underground deposit in the blue, actually both of them, the pits also have to be kept dry during mining operations, so you have to pump water out of there. That has the effect of lowering the ground table and probably affecting water levels in the creeks. I just haven't seen, they haven't released enough modeling information yet to really talk about what, you know, the water losses would be, but that's the concern. Here's a couple of cartoon pictures that I want to go over with you. The first one is the 20-year 1.2 billion ton mine. We have a tailings pond here, an open pit in orange, and a low-grade or waste rock stockpile here. Back in 2012, here's their 2.0 small mine scenario, which looks pretty much the same if you look at them. Tailings pond in the same place, open pit. There's more waste rock in this particular scenario from 2012. That's because the resource itself is a bit larger, and the mine that they're proposing now is it's high grading. So they're trying to mine, get at as much mineral with the least amount of waste rock production in the short run. In the long run, when you go to develop a total resource, you've got to pay that back. There's still same amount of ore, same amount of waste to move. So subsequent developments would have to mine relatively more waste rock. You've probably all heard numerous times about the EPA watershed and about the modeling it did. Again, here is the Pebbles 2017 proposal, open pit, waste rock, tailings pond. Here is the EPA small proposal, open pit, waste rock, tailings pond, same locations. This footprint is a little smaller than this one. The tonnage that EPA had theoretically mined is only about a quarter of what Pebble is proposing in its small mine, so it's less, and the conclusion of EPA based on this footprint was that this was too large, that it caused too much environmental damage. EPA also looked at a 6.5 billion ton scenario, which is the same size that Pebble looked at as its build-out scenario in 2012. And here's what they came up with. It's a little harder to see, but there's a mine pit with waste rock on either side, three different tailings impoundments to hold 6.5 billion tons. And again, that's only half the resource. If we take another look at the area, and I'm sorry, this is the best picture I could find, but this would be your open pit here. Here's the tailings dam in the location that we've been looking at. It sort of goes between these two hills, using the hilltops. To take a total amount of tailings, which would be an additional 9 billion tons on what they're proposing in their 2017 proposal, I think they're going to have to come down to the North Fork and probably put a dam in somewhere in here and back tailings all the way up into this area. So the PLP, when it did its 2012 pre-feasibility study, didn't give us layouts for the 6.5 and 10.7 billion ton build out. So we don't have cartoons to show you on that. But it would mean mining the whole resource, would mean bigger open pits, it would mean underground block caving, which they don't predict for this round. It would mean finding a location for an additional 9 billion tons of tailings on top of the 1.1 that they're talking about now. And then there's going to be an unknown but very large amount of waste rock. What that pre-feasibility study says is that their stripping ratio for the build out of the mine is roughly 2.6 to 1. In other words, for every ton of ore that comes out, they've got to mine 2.6 tons of waste, and you've got to place that. It's normally always placed around the pit, and waste rock is very problematic in that it almost always has the same geochemical makeup that ore does. It just doesn't have enough of the minerals that you need in an ore to process it, so you have to throw it away. So the footprint is probably going to involve this whole area and probably that whole area of the North Fork. And then finally, what's the prospect for additional mining out there? Here we have the Pebble deposit. Even on the Pebble property, they've identified half a dozen additional zones of gold, copper, silver, molybdenum mineralization that they might be able to develop if the infrastructure is in place. Due to the Pebble mine itself, then all of these other zones become potentially economic. And then in the Bristol Bay area itself, here we have Lake Iliamna. There's a big chunk north of Pebble. There's Humble out to the west, several other prospects in the immediate area. And I know that there's also a number of prospects over here to the south of Lake Iliamna that aren't even on this chart. So I think there's, you know, considerable potential for additional mineral development in this area, and it all has a footprint. And I'd like to just leave you with the message again that size is important, because size not only relates to habitat that's directly impacted, but it also relates to, for instance, the size of these waste piles. And the waste piles and the open pit are often associated with contamination, and a lot of that contamination takes years to manifest itself. So it's typically that we don't even see the nature of some of the problems, either because we fail to predict them or there's been some unintended consequences that we, again, didn't predict. So it can take a long time for these issues to develop. And this is a very sensitive area. It's located, the mining at Pebble in particular is located right on top of, or underneath, I guess, fisheries habitat. So thank you very much. If you would like to ask questions.
Dr. Chalmers, there is one from Representative Rusher, but first let me ask you, the Humble and D&H blocks, who owns those claims? if you know.
I don't right offhand. I'm just forgetting about Humble. That's undergoing fairly active exploration at the moment.
Okay.
Drilling out there. I don't think there's anything going on at Big Chunk right at the moment. But.
Okay. All right. Representative Rusher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, have you You said somewhere back on, what is it, page 5, somewhere, 25 to 35% accuracy. Is that the word you used there for? And I was wondering where that originates from.
That comes from the literature, as it were. There are basically three types of feasibility studies. The first one is a, I forget the exact designation, but it's basically a an estimate, a rough estimate. The accuracy is generally 50%. Then you go into a pre-feasibility study where the accuracy is 30 to 40%, and then a full feasibility study, the accuracy there is generally 10 to 15%. And you generally don't see a full feasibility study until a mine plan is pretty solid, because those full feasibility studies are very expensive to conduct. So the company generally won't do that until it's sure that it's got a mine plan it's going to stick with.
And through the chair.
Yes.
And we're at 50% with this?
50, 30 to 40, and 10 to 15 are the three ranges.
And this particular, excuse me, Chair, this particular layout is 50%, 15%?
The one that they did in 2012 was a pre-feasibility, so that would be the 30 to 40.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Chambers, some of your slides suggest a lack of confidence in Pebble's public comment that it intends to limit the mine, and after a 20-year phase, while it did say it would consider expanding it, it speaks in a limited sort of time frame that that we should just consider the limitations of the new plan. And you sound skeptical of that. I mean, that's what I take from your testimony.
I guess it's more than skepticism. I'm just trying to be realistic. You know, companies will always go out and basically propose an initial phase of a mine that's based on a very solid economic case, but not almost always, again, not full development of the resource, because in many cases, and Pebble is one of them, they don't really know what the full extent of the resource is. So you want to get your infrastructure in on the ground, and then once you've got that on the ground, you go to the next phase and the phase following. And mines expanding after their initial footprint is the rule rather than the exception.
Thank you.
In other words, don't take a business risk initially that you don't have to. So,
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your presentation. I like it. I like the pictures, and I have to tell you, as the only Alaska educated and trained mining engineer in the building, this kind of stuff excites me, and it excites me for a couple of reasons. It excites me for the opportunity. I'm an optimist. Just doing a little back of the envelope, calculation on the value of the resource, and I would note that this was on state. The reason it was staked as a mineral resource is it was on state-owned lands and is identified for mineral potential. So in that capacity, it approximates, if I just looking at current silver, gold, molybdenum, and copper valuation, it looks like it's in the excess of $300 billion in potential valuation, which you know is very significant as a prospect and a development, and certainly as a working opportunity for Alaskans, for a resource opportunity for the state. And as an optimist, I have to ask you, do you see a potential for co-location? I mean, we've kind of seen it in the Western United States between the coal miners and the farmers. You know, they find coal underneath. They have to graze, and they have to kind of work together. We see it in Alaska in a lot of cases. And I mean, do you see any potential with that kind of a evaluation as far as an asset to where there's some the mineral development can be pursued and the fishery can be pursued at the same time?
So in this particular location, it's interesting. I had a foundation ask me last week what potential or actual mining operation in Alaska poses the largest risk to habitat, and it was a no-brainer. This one, it's all a matter of location. And the main thing that works against Pebble, in addition to its size and the habitat that it's disturbing, is that this particular type of mine has a very poor record of environmental performance. I mean, virtually every mine of this size developing a copper porphyry ore body has had water quality issues, ranging from sulfate to acid mine drainage. And then I guess I'd like to add one other comment, if I could. One of the things that came out of the Mount Polley mine failure evaluation, which was done by a panel largely of academic and industry mine researchers and practitioners, was that we need to try to place a balance between economic, environmental, and social, in this case, risks. And unfortunately, the way things are done today, we tend to place more emphasis on economics. And the question is, I think socially, how do we try to level that playing field and make the considerations equal?
Follow up. Alaska, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Alaska has a rich tradition. I mean, I walk my dog in the morning across the way here on Sandy Beach, which is basically tailings from one of the largest gold mines in the world. In Fairbanks, we had the Davidson Ditch and the operations up there. I spent a lot of time in the Northwest Arctic, and they actually have to put a weir up to keep the fish out of the tail race going out of the Red Dog mine because of the quality of the work done there. So I guess I am an optimist, and I am of the view that there's a solution here, and it's going to take the good work of people such as yourself, people in the community, and recognition that sometimes we need to take a look at where those opportunities lie and what we need to do for opportunity for our kids and their kids. And when you have a world class resource like this, I think it bears a lot of demand that we focus on that and do it right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Dr. Chambers, a couple things. Representative Birch talked about how the land use plan for this area designated the area in question for minerals. And I looked at this issue intensively around 2014. And what I found was that the tribes, effectively, toward the mouth, that is toward the bay, appealed a management plan in a case called Non-Dalton, if I recall correctly. The department was then forced to rewrite the management plan, and it found that this area was mixed use, that yes, some of it was for mineral exploration, but literally next door to it, in sort of a checkerboard fashion almost, there were areas designated for habitat. Am I right about that?
I believe you are. Not being an attorney, okay. That's probably a question for them. But I am familiar with the issue of the state plan. And one thing I also find it interesting is that back in the 1970s, the legislature said that there was to be no oil drilling in that whole area. So they eliminated that part of resource extraction. I'm not sure why oil mining would be okay and oil drilling wouldn't.
I guess my other question for you is you testified late last February, so just about a year ago, about spending time with tribal members reviewing the core sites, that is the core sample sites, and whether they had been effectively, I guess, plugged or abandoned properly. And I asked General Hamilton about that, and he essentially assured me that all was well. But that isn't my recollection of your testimony and the testimony of those who came with you last February. Can you tell the committee, we have some new members, can you tell the committee whether in your view the sites you toured, I know there's 1,500 plus and you couldn't tour them all, whether they were properly closed?
So a little bit of history on that. We decided to go out and look at how exploration drilling wells reclamation was going on. We ended up going out in August of 2016. We were out there exactly 1 week after the state had done its inspection tour. And after that tour, they said everything was fine. We documented, I think, some issues that all of you have seen in those photos. So things weren't fine. Things weren't being done according to requirements. I know the state went out there again this year and again has said everything is okay. I hope to go back out in the field and look myself. One of the things that I'm a bit concerned about, even if they have gone out and cut off all the well casings at ground level, which they were required to do and hadn't, but prior to 2008 they had made it a practice of dumping their drill cuttings out on the surface. And what I found when I was out there last time was that those a good number of those drill cuttings that were left on the surface have turned acidic. And while it isn't a severe environmental problem, nonetheless, I think the state should, one, require that those things be cleaned up to whatever extent that they can, and two, that practice be officially desanctioned, as it were, by the state. And neither of those things have happened so far. The state did. I did review the state's report this year. They went out and they covered well over 300 sites in 2 days. So they're not putting boots on the ground, as it were. It's all an aerial helicopter, but aerial survey.
So you're not impressed that the department is giving it the scrutiny it deserves?
I'm totally neutral at this point, but I want to go out and see.
Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Chair. I did notice that you actually said how the reclamation was going on was what you went out to observe. And so actually it was in process.
No, most of the holes that we looked at were supposed to have been reclaimed.
Through the chair?
Yes.
I guess I'm just trying to get clarification. Was it in the process or was it completed, finished, and now it's done?
Well, there's basically two types. You can leave a hole temporarily open if you're using it for something. There were several of those. Those aren't the ones we criticized. The ones that we looked at were ones that were supposed to be completely reclaimed, and so those included sites that were leaking, of which none should, and sites that had drill pipes and again, that were sticking up and posing a safety hazard.
Through the chair.
Follow-up, Representative Rauscher.
Thank you. I'm just trying to figure out whether they were, according to the state, signed off on those. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir. They were.
Yeah. Thank you.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, I'm looking at the presentation that we received last week. And there was one page of it that really jumped out at me. That was the cover page in which they said, the purpose of the presentation is to facilitate discussions with stakeholders and does not represent an economic analysis, technical mine study, detailed engineering proposal, or similar study. It should not be used as the basis for any investment decision. Did this presentation, which they gave their shareholders, have a similar disclaimer?
Not to my knowledge.
Well, then, I'll...
Follow up, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll confess myself kind of a little bit irritated that the legislature was given a degraded presentation. And you can go through. I'm looking at slide 4 of it, which is identical to one of the sub-slides that you have here in the presentation, except that large areas have been colored in, blocked out, to prevent us from reading mine pit waste rock and tailing storage facility. And that's for the 2.5 billion ton scenario. I guess what I'm getting at is, why should in your opinion, why would we receive a presentation which consists of a partially redacted and legally shielded version of a more comprehensive presentation given to shareholders? I suppose as a shareholder of the state of Alaska, I wouldn't expect anything less.
I would have to say that to just follow the guide of the Pebble Partnership itself. It said that it's presenting a small mine that's environmentally friendly, and I don't think that's being honest, quite frankly. It's not going to be a small mine, and it's not going to be environmentally friendly.
Representative Parrish, while I share your concern about I share some of your concerns, that's what I'll say, but I am looking at something that General Hamilton gave us that's figure 2-1 mineside hydrography, and it does, I don't know, I mean, it shows a tailings cell, it's called, and a management pond and open pits and the like. So I'm not sure. All right, any other questions for Dr. Chambers? Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Dr. Chambers, thanks for being here today. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but one of the things was size is important. So as plans progress, and if this, you had mentioned risk assessment, obviously from the original plan into this, as if this grows smaller and smaller, do we assume risk assessment goes down because of volumes?
Well, I think the risk probably goes down in relation to the size, but the takeaway from the EPA study is that their mine is smaller than the mine that's being proposed, and it was judged to be unacceptable. The EPA's small mine was judged to be unacceptable because of the impacts on habitat, aquatic habitat, streams, and connected wetlands. So as it gets bigger, it's not obviously not going to get any more acceptable.
And we need to go to the next presenter. But Dr. Chambers, what do you take from the current EPA's statement about continuing concern? What can you give me an elementary version of how it differs from the previous administration's concerns? Is there something you can tell us that will help us?
Well, I was, to say it lightly, very surprised. I did not think that would be their position. I thought they would reverse as they had announced their intention to. So the fact that they didn't was significant. And basically what that does is it allows the mine to go through the environmental impact assessment process now, but leaves EPA's options open.
Okay. Thank you. Seeing no other questions, we'll now move on to Dr. Daniel Schindler's presentation.
Thank you. I'm Daniel Schindler. I'm a professor of aquatic and fisheries sciences at the University of Washington. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and I'll be talking about Bristol Bay fisheries and water quality and what might be at risk from mining development there, particularly from the Pebble. And I want to start by setting the context with how remarkable Alaska's fisheries are. They are the envy of the world. And the fishery management in place is the envy of most places in the world. And what I'm showing you on the top slide here is a history of the number of sockeye salmon that have returned to Bristol Bay rivers over the last 50 years or so. And let's just check in on the numbers here. You know, there are anywhere between 30, 40, 50 million fish per year. And some of the highest returns have been observed in the last decade. The Nooshogak Fishing District alone last year caught 1 million sockeye salmon in one day. Okay, there's no enhancement there. There's no hatcheries. That is watersheds functioning the way they should. Why is this so important? What does this tell us about what sustainable fisheries are based on? And Alaska is a great example. It's part of your culture. It's in your constitution. Sustainable fisheries are part of the Alaska Constitution. There's a very effective management agency. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has done a remarkably good job at managing this system. And the last one, which we can't lose sight of today, is the fact that the habitat is intact. And this is no fluke. We go to the lower 48, and many of our fisheries, particularly our salmon fisheries, are in a total state of disarray. And that can be traced to the fact that we have been arrogant about how important habitat is to sustaining salmon fisheries. The habitat's still on the table in Alaska. The group I work with at the University of Washington has been studying Bristol Bay salmon and their habitats since 1946, before Alaska was a state. The fishing industry came to the University of Washington because they were concerned about sustainability. And they asked the University of Washington to start asking, well, what should be protected, what should be managed if we want to keep these fisheries going in perpetuity, or at least for a very long period of time. And as many of you presumably, or I'm sure, know, is salmon spend about half their lives in the North Pacific Ocean. They return to each of their major rivers. And then even within their individual rivers, they return to the individual stream where they themselves were born, and that's where they spawn. How do they get there? They smell their way home. Again, we don't fully understand this scientifically, but we do know that they are smelling the chemistry of the water, and that's how they get back to their home stream. That's where they spawn. And as a result, when we think about habitat and fisheries, salmon fisheries in Alaska, we need to think about both the coarse scale, how productive is the ocean, but we also need to think about the details of the specific habitat where individual salmon come back to spawn. The discussion today is really not about passing judgment about mining, and it's not about passing judgment on mining in Alaska. We're talking about mining in Bristol Bay and what specific impacts it has on this ecosystem. Bristol Bay is unique geologically and biologically for a few reasons. This image here I lifted off someone from the web is just an example of the types of complex habitat that we see on Bristol Bay watersheds. And what is produced by is the fact that 20,000 years ago, 15,000 years ago, as the glaciers retreated, they left a layer of gravel across the whole region. On top of that, we have a lot of water that falls as rain and snow, and those two things together are what create such productive salmon habitat. Water flows relatively freely across the landscape, and that's, of course, what allows salmon to thrive in these locations. That same issue that makes it good for salmon is what makes it difficult to contain mining problems. Water flows across this landscape. And if we look to the future, climate is changing in Alaska. One of the things we're expecting, again, based on scientific models, etc., is that it will become wetter in a warmer future. Probably will continue to get better for salmon, but when we start thinking about risks in the future, we need to think about the fact that there's probably going to be more water on the landscape, and the landscape is porous. I'm going to give you two examples today to demonstrate, let the fish tell us, what does habitat look like when we think about where our fish produced from the watersheds of Bristol Bay? And these are not intended to be comprehensive examples. They're meant to be illustrative examples of what we now know about how fish use habitat in Bristol Bay. And the first one I'll show you here, I hope you can see the screen below you, is for Chinook salmon, excuse me, returning to the Nooshinggak River. So on the map up here, we see the Nooshinggak River, and on the bottom right, we see a pile of fish. Those are fish that were caught by the commercial fishery. And we know they were produced from the Nooshinggak River, but because they were caught in the ocean, we don't know what parts of the watershed were they born in. What parts of the watershed produced those fish? Well, through some of the magic of modern science, we can start answering that question. So on the left side of this figure is a obscure-looking object, which is an otolith. This is the ear stone of a salmon. It's in the head of the fish. It uses it for navigation. And this thing is smaller, maybe a quarter the size of your fingernail. And it accumulates rings on it as the fish grows up through time. So when that fish is tiny, this thing is a speck of dust, and over the course of its life, this otolith continues to grow. And it incorporates the chemistry derived from the water that the fish is in at any point in time. Well, we can then catch a fish in the ocean, for instance, pull out its otolith, and what I'm showing you here is a cross-section where we've cut it into a fine slice, and you can see the rings on there. I hope you can see the rings on there. And then we can take a laser and zap the middle of that otolith and determine what its chemical constitution is. We can then take that chemical composition and place it on a map in the Nooshagak River and ask, where did that fish come from? So on the map here, what you're seeing is the Nooshagak River Basin. It flows out to the bottom left here near Dillingham. And we see the major tributaries. And what's color-coded here is an intensity that's proportional to how many fish were produced from that tributary from fish that were caught in 2011. And up to the right of this watershed is the Mulchatna River. And this tributary here is the Kuktuli River. And this is in the vicinity of the Pebble Deposit. And you can see that in 2011, of fish that were caught in the fishery, not many of them came out of these tributaries. They're pretty white. So down in the legend here, the higher the intensity of the red, the more productive that tributary is. And you can see the Mulchatna and the Kuktuli were white that year. It didn't produce many fish that returned to spawn in 2011. Well, take a look as I shift into 2014.
Next slide.
Next slide. And I'm just going to toggle back and forth, but here's 2014. Now what we see is the Mulchatna is bright red. I'm going to go back to 2011. Mulchatna is white, and the northern part of the upper Nooshagak is red. 2014, the Mulchatna is red. So the point here is that fish habitat is variable across space, but it's also variable through time. And this is the primary reason we think fisheries in Bristol Bay are so sustainable. And the analogy we like to use is an investment portfolio. So if you diversify your investment portfolio, whether it's in business or through your personal retirement, typically you would diversify to reduce the risks of some catastrophe somewhere. In the case of Bristol Bay fisheries, we are benefiting implicitly from a portfolio of habitat and the portfolio of fish that map onto it. So what this means is that when we start talking about risks of development, we need to ask, well, what are the risks going to do, not only to an individual tributary that may be directly impacted, but also the potential for eroding the portfolio that benefits fisheries in a broader scale. I'll give you one more example here looking at very small spatial scales. So this is within
If I may just briefly, yeah. Would it be your belief that from the time of Christ on or and before that you'd see this sort of switching back between the Nooshagak and Mulchatna and this sort of spread of sort of the investment portfolio as you described it?
Yeah, excellent question. We can't do this for Chinook salmon, but we've done it for sockeye salmon. We've used similar tricks where we've taken the sediments out of the bottom of lakes, and of course sockeye are more associated with lakes, and we've used those sediments and their isotope characterizations to ask how many fish were in these lakes back 100, 200, 500, even 2,000 years. And we see the exact same dynamic play out. That different rivers are simply marching to the beat of different drums, and these portfolio effects play out at millennial timescales as well.
Okay, thank you. I've started now. Representative Birch.
Well, thank you. Well, far more, and I appreciate the maps are helpful, far more recent than the time of Christ, about 100 years ago, we had the Katmai eruption, which dumped, I don't know, it's around 1912, and arguably, you know, 7 cubic miles of ash. And I'm just wondering how that impacted, I mean, obviously a horrific event, significant event. And I'm just wondering how that impacted fisheries and does that, I mean, how resilient is the fishery to some sort of catastrophic event like mm-hmm. that or, you know, natural occurring event? Was this area impacted? I mean, did you see like a couple feet of ash? And I'm not familiar yep. with how that might have happened in that area.
Thank you for your question. It is true that the Katmai eruption deposited ash across this entire region. The bottom of these lakes has a layer that's buried down maybe a foot and a half. That is a layer of Katmai ash. Wow. And whether this caused damage to the fish or, in fact, boosted them really depends on the location. Volcanic ash is very rich in phosphorus, which is known to fertilize lakes. And in some cases, chances are it actually boosted salmon production. So again, if you ask about the impacts of something in the case of Katmai, it probably is very location-specific. In the direct outfall of Katmai, chances are there were salmon streams that were devastated by it. And I like your use of the term resilience, because one thing that is clear from Alaska's salmon watersheds is they are resilient. But we have to ask, why are they resilient? And the reason they're resilient is because of the complexity that I just showed you. Certain parts of the watersheds can be wiped out and be recolonized by others. And if you're concerned about sustaining fisheries for commercial purposes or sport purposes or subsistence purposes, it's the complexity of the system that gives you the reliability.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. So I think you're at slide 9.
Slide 9, I want to provide one more example. Again, just to illustrate, what does habitat look like to a fish? And what does that tell us about what aspects of fish habitat we should protect? This is the little stream of interest, Bear Creek, nowhere near the mine, but again, it's an illustration. And it has wetlands associated with the main channel. And the characters of interest here are juvenile coho salmon, shown here in the left, and their interaction with sockeye salmon, which also spawn in that stream. And here's an aerial photograph of the stream. It starts up here in a beaver meadow to the upper right, and it flows downhill and out to a lake down here at the bottom left. The stream, because of groundwater influence, starts warm at the top, and then it eventually cools down and is about 8 or 10 degrees colder near the bottom of the stream. This little picture here of a coho has a bulging gut, and what it's full of are the eggs of sockeye salmon. So for coho salmon, which are again about the size of your finger in this case, most of their annual growth is achieved by feeding on the eggs of sockeye salmon. Sockeye salmon spawn in the cold water here that has lots of oxygen that enables their eggs to develop throughout the winter. The coho eat those eggs, but we find the coho way up here, a mile away in warm water. The reason for that is that if they sit in the cold water with a belly full of eggs, they can't digest them. They have to find warm water so their metabolism warms up and they can digest them. So the question is, do you have individual fish that move between warm and cold parts of the stream? We can put these little antennas in the stream, put tags in these fish, and then listen for them and say, are they moving around and exploiting the habitat? Here's one example of a little coho that we put in the top reach of the stream, section 3, that's warm, and then we listened for it, and then about 3 days later it swam down. This is about a mile in distance, spent about 3 or 4 hours in the cold part of the stream, probably binging on eggs, and then it swam back up. This fish is this big, and it's swimming a mile each way in one night to exploit the variation in the environment. It's going to get the eggs in the bottom cold spot, it's going up to the warm part to warm up and digest those things. So the message here is that the habitat to a coho, what's important about that habitat is both variation in temperature, but also the ability to connect those different pieces of habitat. You take away the connectivity, you take away all the benefits of that habitat. So when we look at what does fish habitat look like in Bristol Bay, it's about complexity and variation. And these are the attributes that make reliable fisheries. So when we start talking about risks, it's easy to think about the big catastrophic events of mine tailings, dams collapsing, and these sort of things. We need to think about the subtle and chronic effects of the infrastructure that goes along with mines, roads, power lines, etc. These are the things that will also add to the risks because they simplify the habitat. So here's a very long list of risks. This list is not complete, but I wanted to give you an example of what sort of risks we have to think about when we assess how might development affect fish. These are facts. These are not hypotheticals. The actual magnitude of these impacts is going to depend on a lot of things. It's going to depend on the location. It's going to depend on how the mine actually operates. But these issues, as stated here, are facts. There's no denying that. So we know that this deposit will produce acid mine drainage. The word that it's interesting that no one uses is it's sulfuric acid. This is the acid that's in your car battery. Copper, which is one of the main minerals that is being sought here, will become more soluble as waters acidify, and copper is a known toxin to fish. In the case of salmon, it can have very direct effects at very high concentrations, but the thing we can't forget about is that there are what we call indirect effects of copper on fish. And one of them is it impedes, it affects their ability to smell. So when I started this talk, I told you about the fact that salmon go home to their natal stream to spawn. The way they get there is by smelling their way home. Well, if the stream is full of copper, even at very low concentrations, it has the possibility of reducing their ability to smell their way home, smell their predators, etc. Dust, groundwater erosion, all of these things make containment of contaminants challenging. This is unique to Bristol Bay in lots of ways. Dewatering streams and wetlands is part of the issues of developing a mine of this magnitude, and as I hope I showed you earlier, those small streams and small wetlands are critical pieces of fish habitat. Putting roads and pipelines in and other infrastructure prevents erosion. And from a human infrastructure standpoint, erosion is something we don't want. From the perspective of maintaining fish habitat, erosion is a good thing. It's what generates the variation in the habitat that they exploit. The list goes on, and I want to finish by saying that many of these impacts are permanent. And last, some of these risks take decades to express themselves. 10 years from now, some of these risks may not be expressed. It may take 50 or 100 years for them to really play out. The EPA assessment has been widely criticized for a variety of reasons, one of which is that it develops scenarios and that they assess risks without a specific mine plan. Well, the reality, what they did is they ran some scenarios, and it turns out that scenario planning is a standard exercise in the military, in the case of how large corporations operate, and in fact of doing science. A lot of cases we can't see the future, so we run scenarios to ask, well, what is the scope for change in the future? And in the case of the EPA assessment, all of these risks show up, whether the mine plan is the small one they considered or the large one they considered. Here's a photo of the Samarco tailings dam failure from Brazil 2 years ago. It's an iron mine. Now, this is the sort of thing that captures the media's attention and has substantial risk to the public viewing of mining. Okay. Here's another one. Here's Mount Pauley. It's been brought up several times. These are large catastrophic events that clearly have potential for risk to fish. But if we're going to assess the risks to fish and fish habitat in Bristol Bay, you need to think about the subtle issues and the chronic issues that may take a long time to develop. It's the death of a thousand cuts issue. The risks aren't only about the tailings dam failure. They're much broader. And this is particularly, I'll give you one example of this. This is not associated with a mine. This is the Chena River near Fairbanks. And this is a beautiful image taken by satellite. Chris Stark from UAF provided this with me. You see the Chena River here, and what I'm pointing to is the main channel of that river. But if you look back here, this is where that river used to meander. And the fish that live in the main river are certainly using these back channel wetlands as part of their habitat. The road is certainly disconnecting that habitat from the main channel. There's probably culverts in there, but over longer periods of time, what the road is doing in this case is preventing the river from wandering across that floodplain and generating new habitat. This is just one example of the types of chronic effects that could play out over decades and centuries, and we need to think about these if we're going to think about development. And this is particularly true if we look at the regional scale of Bristol Bay. This is a map produced by Trout Unlimited a few years ago. I realize some of it is out of date. The simple point is that there are a lot of deposits in this region. And we need to ask, is pebble the first domino to fall here? If you cover this area in mines, tailings ponds, roads, pipelines, etc., you can guarantee you're taking away options for fish. And this has to be part of the assessment when we think about risks to Alaska and its fisheries relative to the rewards of pulling minerals out of the ground. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rauscher?
birch and then tar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, back on slide 13, maybe? Yeah, there you go. Bullet number two, the item about copper. I fish the Copper River. And so I'm just kind of wondering how that, I mean, it's some of the most sought after fish in the country, if not the world. I just wonder how that fits in with bullet number two.
You're right. It is true that there is copper in the environment, in the environment naturally. The question here is that with acid mine drainage, you make the water more acidic, which makes copper more soluble. And if you increase the concentrations of copper, it has the potential to prevent fish from smelling. So again, to quantify that is going to depend on a lot of things, including the local chemistry, the local how much copper is in the rock that's flowing, that the stream is flowing over, etc. What we do know is that, and Dr. Chambers can give us more data on this if we ask for it, but there's obviously a lot of copper in these rocks. There's a lot of potential to produce sulfuric acid, and there's very little buffering capacity of those rocks. We should expect that the copper concentration of these waters will increase.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I've driven that road along the Chena River. It gets a lot of use. It's a good road, and it's good access. So, you know, it's a balancing act. This is expensive work, and how are you funded, or how is your work funded, and how is the University of Washington engaged in this? It's good work. I mean, it looks very comprehensive, but who's writing the checks for all the research that's going on here through the chair?
We have a diverse portfolio. you know, the inception of our program was from funding from the fishing industry. And they have been a partner at some level since 1946. In the last 20 years or so, in particular, about the time that I became part of our research program, we started diversifying. In the last 20 years, the National Science Foundation, which are peer-reviewed grants provided by the federal government, has been a large part of what we've done. The Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, which is a private foundation, has provided us lots of funding recently. We work in partnerships with Bristol Bay Science at BBSRI, with BBRSDA and the Fishermen's Association, with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So the research that I've presented today has been funded by a wide variety of funding sources. Personally, you know, the work I've presented today, I have received no payment for.
Follow up. What's going on in the hatchery world? Is the University of Washington engaged in that at all?
I'm going to make this very brief because we have other people to testify.
Do you want to open that can of worms? I mean, the University of Washington has a long history of hatchery work.
Okay.
And we have backed off on it recently because what keeps coming to the front is that hatcheries cause more damage to wild stocks than they do good for fishing communities.
Okay. I'm just curious because I had that association. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, sure. Mr. Chairman.
All right. Any other yes, Representative Torr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And pardon me. I actually was sort of on that last point. You did briefly mention, but I just wonder, as the person who's the fishery researcher here, about the importance of this fishery because of it being an entirely wild fishery, not supplemented with any hatchery stock. And so just if you have any other additional comments, I mean, I just feel like that kind of gets lost in the conversation here about how special that is.
Yeah, thank you for your question. That's an excellent question because we do hear that hatcheries are one solution to making up for lost habitat. One of the things that's special about Bristol Bay salmon is that their unique genetic diversity is still intact. Go to the Columbia River, go to most places in British Columbia, go to any place south of Washington, and hatcheries have essentially, I'm going to use this term loosely, but polluted the genetics of wild stocks. Fish do home to their natal stream, but there's always a few renegades who go spawn somewhere else. And we know this in spades from lots of places with cutting-edge science, is that the genes from hatchery fish make their way into wild fish and can take away some of the fitness of those wild populations. Hatcheries are not the solution to this problem. Maintaining the habitat is what you need to do if you're going to maintain fisheries here.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, at this time I would invite Senator Rick Halford to come before us. And place your name on the record. Sir, we know who you are, but I have real confidence in who you are. But I'm going to ask you to do that anyway, and tell us your affiliation.
Hi, I'm Rick Halford. I work on a program with United Tribes. I have worked with most of the groups that are involved in Bristol Bay, and also flown for most of the news organizations and everyone that has been involved in the issue. Following Daniel Schindler is absolutely impossible. And I've flown him around, I've listened to him, and I try to absorb the things that he says. And every time I think I understand something, he adds another variable. But then he also says that there's variables beyond what he knows. So I just end up with the system is magic. And I guess the rule is if you can't fix it, don't mess it up. But I very much appreciate your time. I certainly am not an anti-mining person. Sitting in this room, I think, was when I introduced the upgrade of the mining law when the mining industry lost the court case on moving land from the patentable federal stuff into state lease provisions. And I don't think I ever ran for office without the support of the Alaska miners. Finding this particular issue and listening to it and spending years with it, this is one of those that doesn't work. Most of them do work, and this one could have worked if it were in a different place. But the location is the most critical you could ever find. The type of ore body and the size are beyond imagination. You had a presentation which was really, Dr. Chambers said, a series of cartoons. I think that was, if you want a presentation of what they're talking about, look at Appendix D of their application, because that is the simplest 80 pages of what they're proposing to do, and it's not a presentation. If you look at the presentation, it's full of disclaimers. And even the application itself is full of statements about particularly things like water balance, which are hugely complicated and beyond my understanding. But they're full of statements that we will find out, we will develop, we will learn, and that's what it's based on. One of the first pieces that I'd like to mention, just for maybe it's entertainment, but the first time the Cross the Lake route was considered is referred to in a 2007 report, and it's 1991, and it's from Cominco. Cominco, and I've got the report, it was a DOT report done on access routes, but they rejected it as not worth considering in 1991. And of course, remember, it's not just environmental, it's not just local, but the leaders of the industry worldwide have rejected the Pebble Mine after spending hundreds of millions of dollars to assess it. First Cominco, then Rio Tinto, Mitsubishi, finally Anglo. This is not just something that has environmental problems or support problems. It has huge economic problems because it's a very low-grade ore body. But if you look at the real thing that says something, attachment D of the application, which is not an application to the state, but just to the Corps for one permit. But on page 14, it talks about the size. And it touts the $10.8 billion prospect. And it uses those numbers, as they use for their shareholders, as to what this is about. It's not about the one-tenth proposal that they are talking about in the marketing system, but it's about the whole thing. And I think I'm going to try and pay attention to my slides and maybe move forward. This is what it looks like.
Just for the record, we distributed at least select pages of attachment D. I can see that the entire attachment be forwarded to the committee, and it's an attachment to the Corps of Engineers application
yes.
under NEPA.
Yes.
Is that right?
Okay.
Appendix D.
It's about 80 pages, and if you took out the tables and lists of things, it might get down to about 60 pages. And if you really want to take something home, just read it. It's the one that describes what they're saying.
Please proceed.
But this is what the country looks like. That's a picture of Frying Pan Lake. This is an old slide. It's the same thing that has been brought up before, but it's about what the impact is on the fishery by volume. And what it doesn't say is that, you know, the combination of gravity and the connectivity of water is like blood in the human body. The infection you get from a mosquito bite in your ankle that gives you MRSA destroys your body. And the infection that could happen in this fishery starts by destroying the market, and it goes on from there downhill. So it's not just a numbers game where that infection comes from. It's the reality of the way the water system works, the way the human body works. Water is the blood of the ecosystem. In terms of size, you know, they don't use this slide anymore, but this is the slide that they used up until about 2 years ago, of the actual size of the deposit. And the one they're using now is a little bit before that. But this is where they get the 10.8 billion tons. And if you look at it, it starts 1,000 feet above sea level, and it goes to 4,300 or 4,400 feet below sea level. So it's a mile deep, and at the bottom end of the east, doesn't say there's nothing there. It's some of the highest concentrations, and it just says open. So really the minimum potential that they have brought before their shareholders is close to 11 billion tons, which is absolutely unimaginable in comparison to anything else. This slide you've seen before. It's been in the consideration of size, but if you put the size of the Donlin deposit on this slide, it would be about a third bigger than the Fort Knox piece, and it would still be astronomically smaller than the Pebble resource. So it's important to understand the difference in what they're proposing and what they really mean. I think you know, there's a lot of things about the transportation system that are in this, and they're worth looking at. Blasting twice a day, 25,000 tons a year of explosives, 16 million gallons a year of fuel, 35 round trips a day by trucks, ferry one or two times a day. That's a lot of activity. That's not a small mine. There's a section that's worth reading in this basically real plan, and it's incomplete, but it's at least real. It doesn't have the economic analysis, and it doesn't have the wetlands analysis that will have to be in it to be complete, and probably other things that I haven't noticed. But about page 58 starts talking about the water balance and how it's going to work. You're going to be at the edge of Upper Tularet Creek, which you say you're not going to do anything with, and you're going to eventually get to a 1,750-foot hole in an area that's got 1,300 holes that are uncased and not plugged in any watertight manner. So there's a huge exchange. As they pump out that hole, the upper end of Upper Tularet Creek just about has to disappear. Where that affects what happens is a lot of water balance things, but they have pretty extensive models, but in their application they continuously repeat the disclaimers of this will be set up and this will happen in the way that there's a classic statement that I'm going to try to find about water balance that I think is very worth considering, and it's a question that we should be asking of our state people, because this is a state land issue. The only permit they're applying for is a dredge and fill permit in the waters of the U.S. One piece that was the federal piece in the previous discussion, but now it's back to a state discussion, and you're in charge. But the ultimate project design will incorporate detailed analysis of water collection and management. This is not the ultimate design. This is nowhere near the ultimate design. We don't know where the water goes when you don't know what the bedrock depth is across that whole cross-section. And digging a 1,700-foot hole is, you know, starting at 800 feet, puts you 1,000 feet below sea level, close to 1,000 feet below the bottom of Lake Iliamna,
and it is a huge issue for making this thing work or not work.
And Senator, could you tell us what you just read from, just so
that the was on page 58
okay.
of attachment D, and it's referred to in several different places.
Okay. Thank you.
What they, on page 63, on the same category, I'll read this sentence. The accuracy of water balance models is limited by many factors, including the stochastic nature of inputs. I didn't know what that meant. It means random. So the random nature of inputs and the potential effects of climate change. In recognition of these limitations, an adaptive water management strategy is planned. Adaptive management is, you know, it's what I used to say when people wanted to know what I was going to do and I didn't want to tell them.
All right. please continue.
Okay. Finally, I would like to read you a statement out of this, and you can see what it says to you. It's about what happens if, and of course, none of us believe that they're going to stop in 20 years, but if they did, and the future of the same issue just goes on. I'm going to run through some slides here. This is what it looked like when they started. This is what one of their rigs looked like, and why people are angry about what's happened in their region. But this is what it looks like right now. And this is the Lincoln Lakes. The pit would be a little bit off to the left, but that's that high country right now. Once mining the open pit stops, dewatering will stop, and the open pit will begin to flood. The pit will continue to fill until the pit lake is formed. Surface runoff from the walls may result in metal leaching. Water quality is expected to be acidic with elevated metals due to overall oxidation of the open pit walls. Pit lake water quality will be monitored and appropriate actions will be taken to manage wildlife activity on the lake. Once the level of the pit lake has risen to about 890 feet, water treatment will commence, and they'll have water treatment to keep it from going over the top of that. You know, what this is changing into is Berkeley Pit. We have an example of exactly what happens. The fencing necessary to keep wildlife out, anything that lands on it dies. It goes on and on and on. And this is really what they're promising. And the reclamation and closure bond package will include provisions for periodic replacement of water treatment facilities and ongoing operation and monitoring costs over the long-term post-closure period. This reads like perpetual remediation. And do we have a right to pass that on to the next generation of Alaskans just to monetize something in conflict with the renewable resources that will otherwise go on forever?
Thank you. And the last selection read by Senator Hufford was from page 70
yes.
of the attachment D to the core report or core application, just for so the record's clear about that. We have one more person testifying, so I want to get to him. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you. Through the chair, can you go back a slide?
Back a slide?
No, that's the Pebble Mine area, and they flew us out there this summer. Mm-hmm. And right now you're looking at 1,300 core drilled holes in that area that they've talked about. You know, all the machinery that went out there to core drill 1,300 holes. And so I just want to make that note that that's what you're looking at now after the 1,300 holes have been cored.
I'm not sure that I agree with your statement. I don't think that that's where the 13. Surely some of them were, but I've seen a map of where the core holes are, and it's spread far to the west of Pebble as well.
Here's what they look like. Well, but you're looking at covered. You're looking at cored holes. The machinery had to go out there and do that, correct? Through the chair.
I don't know. I don't know. I only know what the speaker told me that's a view of.
Yes, machinery went out there to do that.
Did they go out to that area? Through the chair.
Yes.
Okay. There you go.
I mean, that's what the holes looked like in the exhibit to the water case that Bella Hammond and Vic Fisher brought in about 2008 or 2009. That was an exhibit in that case. Mm-hmm. But this is, you know, doing it takes
put shoring out there, set up a system, and it was all done by helicopter. This one is a bad example, but there were a lot of good examples, so you can't say that 1,300 holes were, and they weren't all deep holes either. Some of them were geophysical to try and tie into bedrock and other things. But our objection to this one was that it was in basically in wetlands. It's a salmon stream behind us, and as the rig kind of beat itself down into its own shoring, the drilling mud spread everywhere, and it was not a good example from their perspective.
Representative Birch. And then we're going to go to the next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple quick questions. First of all, do you have and I haven't read through all this, but is there an estimate of how many, what type of employment they're looking at? Is it, is there 1,000 people? I mean, I think Red Dog is 300 or 400 people. Is it?
They have that in the presentation you got on Friday.
I missed that one.
Okay. They have that in their presentation. It was their numbers, and I don't know what the numbers were. It was a different number for construction, a different number for operation.
Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
My back-of-the-napkin estimate evaluation was around $300 billion, but you're indicating that it's closer to $30 billion in the current model?
I think so. I know it's about 10% of the total amount, and their numbers were always based on monetizing the full amount.
Okay. And then lastly, as my question to the prior speaker, is this a volunteer deal for you? Are you working for anybody? Or are you?
I have a current contract for advice to United Tribes of Bristol Bay. I have also worked for a number of other organizations that have been representing the area. I started out on my own nickel, flying around at the request of people like Bella Hammond and Luke Iacocca.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Well, it's good to see you, Senator. Thank you.
Nice. All right. Thank you. Let the record reflect that Representative Johnson joined us. We'll now yes.
One thing to put in the record, just because Mr. Hamilton said Pebble wasn't asking for anything but normal standards, I'd just like to introduce to the record, they're right now seeking formal approval under the FAST 41 program that would allow them to have expedited federal review of this permit application. And I've got a copy of Pebble's letter requesting that. So it's not just the simplest, easiest, longest program they're looking for. They also are looking for expedited action.
All right. And we'll distribute. If you give us that, we'll distribute that. Thank you. So now I'd like to invite Mr. Tom Tilden to come before the committee and identify himself, his affiliation or affiliations, and we'll hear
his testimony. Thank you very much. My name is Thomas Tilden. I am a Chukyung Tribal Chief. I'm also a member of the Village Corporation of Chugging Limited, and which I sit on the NAMPTA Board of Directors, who have sent me down here since we have loaned we have land in the lower part of the Inushkak River. For the record, my name is Thomas Tilda. I'm a tribal chief of Chugging Tribe and a board member of Chugging. And then NAMPTA's Alusai is a coalition of Alaska Native village corporations and tribes in the Bristol Bay region. I am a fisherman and the son of Earl Tilden, who came to Alaska from San Jose as a gold prospector in 1932. His diary reads, through the winter of 1932 and 1933, that he would pan for gold in the Mulchatna River, which the Coctula River is a tributary of. He would say, no gold today. Had to cleave 4 inches of ice to pan for gold. And that's how it goes throughout the whole winter, as I read his diary in 1932-33. Meanwhile, on the side notes, he notes that he caught some beaver, he caught some mink, and he got some other fur animals that he had to skin out and clean. Then all of a sudden, his diary goes silent between the months of April through August. And he states that he is going to Dillingham to sell his furs. And then his diary starts up again in August. And he says, I found my gold. And it's not in the mineral form, but from the furs and salmon I caught and sold. I'm a subsistence and a commercial fisherman. That is all I do for a living. I have fished commercially since 1965. I have been a set netter on the Inushkak River, a gill netter for salmon and herring, a seiner for herring, a long liner for halibut. Before my commercial fishing, I make sure that I have smoked, salted, frozen fish put away for the winter. And I do that, and I do this before I go commercially fishing, just like many of the folks in Bristol Bay do. I grew up on the Nooshigak River in the village of Portagequick. Our family lived a subsistence lifestyle, and we depended on natural resources to survive. We took from the river salmon, whitefish, pike, trout, and smelts all year round or seasonally if they are migrating through. We also took muskrat and beaver that swam in the rivers. We also depended on their natural resources that fed us through the winter, such as rabbits and caribou and moose and porcupine. We depended on greens and berries from the land. The air provided us with ptarmigan, geese, and ducks. All of these are abundant along the rivers, and they all depend on clean water. Living a subsistence lifestyle is a full-time job. It's 7 days a week and 364 days a year. There is no break if you live a subsistence lifestyle. It's a full-time job. Our river system is blessed every year on January 19 by our priests. The water is blessed for all who partake in it. We collect that water in containers and use it throughout the year to bless our nets, our boats, our homes, our steams, and to bless us when we are sick. Water is sacred in our lives. Water also provides us with transportation in the winter through the ice, and water through the summer months for transportation and travel. Our rivers need your protection, as all rivers in Alaska need your protection. Article 8 of our Alaska Constitution says that the resources belong to all of us. Protect it for all of us. When we fought for statehood, that was one of the driving forces, was because we would be able to manage our own resources. They didn't say manage until a pebble comes along or some other mining comes along. It said that we would protect those resources. And that's what we expect our legislatures to do. Bristol Bay is a fish-first region. We went to our villages and asked what they wanted in the future. One thing that stood out was preservation of our natural resources. It was a two-year study that we did. All the Bristol Bay organizations were involved in this visioning project that we endured upon. And we held three meetings in each village. We went to the village and asked them, what is it that you want? And they told us. Then we came back and said, after it was written up, we asked them, is this what you said? And they would either confer or make additions or corrections. And the third time we came back with the final report. But one thing that stood out in that study, that three-year program by the BBs, was that they wanted to protect the abundance of natural resources in our area. And they also wanted development, development that did not harm the natural resources that we have in abundance, to protect that. That was the overwhelming message from our visioning project that we took over a two-year period. Pebble has come in from a foreign nation and have promised us jobs. So I went to one of their meetings up in Iliamna and I says, I'm very interested, I'm very happy that you are offering us jobs. I said, could you put that in writing, please? Could you promise us 5% of the jobs on Pebble? They said, no. They would not put that in writing. They say there are jobs, but they will not put a number in writing. They said they would not harm the environment and be good stewards. They said they would raise the bar so that we would be well protected. Well, they took water for 2 years out there without a permit. And that water belongs to all of us, state of Alaska. And they were fined for that. That's not a good steward. That's not a good way to start off a relationship. They didn't follow through and cap their wells as required by the state of Alaska. Only when pressured or when they wanted a renewal did they come back and finally do the job that they were supposed to do in the first place. So during exploration, we have seen impacts, not only from them, but in our natural resources. If you look at their webpage and you follow the Tulare Creek, you will see that they come in and they show you Tulare Creek. Well, that's flying under 700 feet of the aviation requirements. And the caribou that used to migrate in Calvin, that area, have migrated and went other places. The first people to notice that was the people from New Halen when they said they were out moose hunting and could no longer catch a moose because of the noise pollution that was created by the exploration. So there has been negative impacts already to our communities. I have took them up on their offer and went down to look at the Poly, the Gibraltar, and the Highlander mines in Canada. Well, we all know what happened to the Poly. The Gibraltar mine and the Highlander mines cannot be compared to what Pebble is. When you talk to their geologists and the people that run that mine, you'll find out that they have to import water. Whereas in the Pebble, you have to do away with that water. There's too much water. The Gibraltar and the Highlander are in a highland area. The geology is totally different. In Pebble, it's a highland wetland area. Totally, you cannot compare. It's apples and oranges when you take a look at those two mines. The geology and the hydrology are not the same. It worries me when I see two world large companies, Rio Tinto and Anglo, walk away. It really worries me. Because these are the two largest mining companies in the world. And you have to ask, why would they sacrifice $750 million and walk away from it? There's something wrong here, folks. We either got to dig deeper or we got to actually find the truth. We have to find out what happened. We can't go by half-truth, what is being told to us. When I read the article regarding cyanide, use of cyanide, and not using it in Pebble. Well, when I read about cyanide tells me that is the most efficient and most cost-effective way to extract gold. Now, if I'm a shareholder of theirs, and I find out that they're using a less product, I'm going to demand why. Because if I'm a shareholder, I want my dividend. So let's take a look at the state law and see whether or not, if you can say that I will not use cyanide, and if you could amend later on down the road and utilize cyanide, ask them that. But what are their real plans? I think it's time for us to really take a hard look at exactly what they say and what they're doing and what is happening. And not just for us that live along the villages in Bristol Bay, but for the whole state of Alaska. When I look at the state crisis, the budget crisis that we have in the state of Alaska right now, and I wonder, you know, what is it going to be like 100 years from now? What is the state of Alaska going to be dependent on? I just came from San Antonio, and I flushed the toilet down there, and it went poosh. When you flush the toilet here, it goes. It flushes because we have an abundance of water. That's one of the things that the state of Alaska has. And that water is valuable. It's our future. It's something that we're going to be able to utilize. And so maybe old Wally Hickel, when he said that, yeah, let's sell water to the Lower 48, that might be a dream come true 100 years from now. 100 years from now, when all the gold and all the mines have taken what they want and the oil is extracted from the ground, what do we have? We have natural beauty. I believe that the people are, this is going to be a tourist state. We already see the Japanese coming into Fairbanks to watch the Northern Lights. We see these folks coming up to fish, to hunt. I see that along those rivers. I think it's time that we protect the Bristol Bay watershed as well as the whole state of Alaska, protect its waters, make sure that they don't get polluted. And I'd like to end my saying with a quote from Bella Hammond. In 2009, she says, "It is time to decide what we really value." And I really believe her. It is time. There's a big decision that you are going to make. What is history going to say about you 100 years from now? But thank you very much. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Tilden. We'll take one question, then we have some housekeeping. We have to surrender the room to Labor and Commerce. Representative Birch.
Chief Tilden, I, through the chair, I just wanted to thank you for your testimony and your engagement and your community participation. But one thing, I'm still trying to get my head around harvesting a porcupine. How do you do that besides very carefully?
Very carefully.
Thank you.
So, first of all, I want to thank everyone for appearing and testifying. Some quick housekeeping. This Wednesday, we plan to hear from Commissioners Hartig and Cotton regarding the proposed Pebble Mine. We will be revisiting House Bill 267 on municipal taxation of guiding, essentially, and hunting. We touched on that briefly last Friday. This Thursday at 1:30, and you may not have, hopefully your staff told you about this, Thursday at 1:30, we plan to meet jointly with House Finance Committee regarding China, LNG, and the proposed Alaska gas pipeline. I'm going to guess that meeting is upstairs. This Friday, we plan to hear from Commissioner Mack regarding the proposed Pebble Mine and revisit House Bill 305. That's on smaller spills, often in people's homes and that sort of thing. That's the governor's bill. Again, thank you, everybody. We will adjourn this meeting at 3:08.